Welcome to another episode of the Deborah Health Report, where we dive into current health and medical topics to keep the Delaware Valley informed and updated. Last month, we focused on arrhythmia diagnosis, treatment, and management, and even addressed some of the new social media claims about self-help to reset your heart rhythm. This month, we discuss diagnosing and treating valvular heart disease, the high-tech present of minimally invasive care at Deborah Heart and Lung Center, and the exciting future in the heart valve research space. Here's Rasa Kay.
Hi, I'm Rasa Kay. We're looking at valvular disease in the heart when one of the four valves that keep blood moving through the heart in the right direction starts to stick or even spring a leak. It can be a symptom-free state for years. It can start to speed up with little to no warning. And if you and your doctor aren't on top of it, you can actually miss your chance to get it fixed. Deborah interventional cardiologist Dr. Muhammad Rasa breaks it all down.
So our heart is a muscular pump. And it has four chambers. And for the proper functioning of the pump, it requires four valves. So on the right side, between the right upper and lower chamber of the heart, there's a valve called tricuspid valve. Then the valve that takes or guides blood to the lungs from the right lower chamber of the heart is called pulmonic valve. And on the left side, between left upper and lower chamber of the heart, is a valve called mitral valve. And then valve that is also called exit valve, where the left bottom chamber of the heart, when pumps blood, it exits through this valve called aortic valve. So there are four valves: tricuspid, pulmonic, mitral, and aortic valve. In regards to are they prone to disease or malfunctioning, yes, all of them are, to varying degrees depending on multiple factors.
All right, let's talk about these dysfunctions and if you could break it down, and especially this older versus younger and how that happens. That would be a different process.
Yes.
Okay.
Why valves go bad? The purpose of the valves is to make sure the blood flows in one direction. So for proper functioning of the heart, the valve has to be functioning properly. How do valves go bad? It's usually there is an underlying disease process. So in younger patients, it is predominantly or more often rheumatic heart disease, which means there is a history of rheumatic fever, and this rheumatic heart disease then slowly but surely destroys the valves, and they end up having valvular heart disease earlier in their age. But as we get older, it's mostly wear and tear of the valves. So valves fail by two mechanisms. One is they don't open well or they don't close well. When they don't open well, we call it valvular stenosis. When they don't shut well, it's called regurgitation. Certain valves more often have regurgitation or they leak, and certain valves more often have stenosis, which means they don't open well. Senior patients, older patients, for example, on the left side of the heart, the aortic valve, which is an exit valve, accumulates calcium as we get older, and the valve leaflets become stiff. So instead of opening like this, they start to restrict opening. And that means that the blood is being blocked by the valve and the heart has to work harder to pump the blood out. So that's aortic valve stenosis. That's the exit valve we talked on the left side of the heart. Whereas the mitral valve, which is between left upper and lower chamber of the heart, it can be primary dysfunction, which means the valve itself is not able to shut properly. The mitral valve is very similar to two half parachutes. So just think about two half parachutes coming together. So the valve opens and then shuts. And there are so many structures of that valve that can go bad. So it could be the valve leaflets itself or the cords underneath it. If there's a dysfunction of the leaflets itself or the cords are dysfunctioning, the valve has a primary dysfunction we call primary mitral valve regurgitation, which means that everything else around the valve is normal, but the valve itself is not functioning normally. So instead of shutting as watertight seal, it leaves a gap. So the blood then leaks back into left upper chamber of the heart. That's called leaky mitral valve or mitral valve regurgitation. Whereas in some cases, the valve leaflets are functioning normally. The leaflets are normal, but the leaflets are inserted into the cardiac chamber, heart chambers. And if those heart chambers start to dilate, get bigger, then the The leaflets of the valve are also stretched or pull apart, and that leads to leaky valve or mitral valve regurgitation. We call it secondary mitral valve regurgitation, which means the valve itself is not a problem. It's the structure around it, which means the heart chamber got larger. And there are multiple reasons why. It could be blockages in the heart. It could be prior heart attack. It could be a dilated cardiomyopathy, which means that the heart muscle is getting weaker and it got larger. And secondarily, the valve started to leak.
You know, I have this image of a door, two doors in a doorway. And so you've got either the doors themselves that aren't shutting properly, that have gotten loose, and or the actual doorway has now gotten kind of flabby and pulling at the hinges of the doors and pulling them apart. Okay, so I mean, it's architecture.
Yes.
And the architecture gets all loosened
up. By wear and tear, yeah. So your example is an excellent one. We actually do explain to our patients, and we give them the example that heart is very much like a house, and the valves are like doors. And as you said, the frame can get larger, and the door itself is okay, but if the door frame is getting larger, then it's not going to shut properly. So that's an excellent example.
These are the wear and tear processes, correct? Mm-hmm. Or would a disease process like rheumatic fever or something also lead to this kind of collapse of the architecture?
Rheumatic fever is a perfect example. There are other infections also, but predominantly rheumatic fever, which is triggered by infection. Fortunately, due to antibiotics use in our country here, rheumatic fever is less and less common, but we do see patients who are immigrants and they never got antibiotics at the time of rheumatic fever or were not properly treated. We see that those patients have damage of their valves from the rheumatic fever. Predominantly in our country here is mostly, as we get senior, it's wear and tear and calcification of the leaflets, and that leads to valve dysfunction.
The stages then, and what are the signs, whether you feel them, whether you as a clinician can find them?
The stages of the valve dysfunction could be mild, moderate, or severe. For simplicity, mild means the valve dysfunction is minimal, and severe means it is advanced and something needs to be done. When the valve dysfunction in the mild range, you can monitor the patient because patient has no symptoms in general. But when the valve dysfunction is more advanced, is in the severe range, that means it will start to have symptoms. And usual symptoms of valvular dysfunction are shortness of breath, fatigue and tiredness, or leg swelling. What ends up happening very often is that valvular heart disease happens more often in patients who are older or senior in their lives. So when they have symptoms, in general, the patient attribute those symptoms to their age. So I'll ask patients all the time, do you get tired? They'll say, yeah, what would you expect from an 80 years old? It's very common that patients don't think this could be a problem with the heart valves. And they also would say, well, the weather has been a little on the cooler side. Well, there are allergies also. Maybe I overdid it. And we keep educating them or counseling them that, you know, this could be your valvular dysfunction that is causing symptoms and nothing to do with any of the other factors. And when we are monitoring patients, let's say the valve dysfunction or disorder is not that advanced, and we're monitoring phase, we educate our patients that if you have these symptoms, shortness of breath, chest discomfort, leg swelling, fatigue and tiredness, please let us know because that is not symptoms of getting older. This is the value of getting these patients referred to us earlier so we can sit down with them, we explain to them what to expect. So if they do have any of those symptoms, then we can act upon sooner than waiting to the last stages. A mild valve disorder may stay mild for a very long time. We have patients, they have mild mitral valve regurgitation at age 60. And, you know, we have been following them, and this is now 15 years later, they still have mild or maybe a little bit of progression to mild to moderate. Mild disease in general is well tolerated, and that's why there's no need to have any therapy, except we have to make sure that patient is getting monitored. Once that valve dysfunction goes into the moderate range or moderate to severe range, then it sets in a vicious cycle. let's say it's mitral valve disease. The job of the mitral valve is to make sure blood is not leaking backwards. It's going forward. The left bottom chamber of the heart, which is the main pumping chamber, is pumping blood. But when the mitral valve is leaking, there's a lot more blood coming back and forth, such that the left bottom chamber of the heart has to work harder. As that chamber is working harder and harder and harder over months to years, it's more likely to have more damage and fail compared to if it's a little bit of a leak.
How long might it take to move from the mild through moderate to a severe stage?
It's very variable. Some patients who have mild disease could last much longer in the mild stage than many other patients. Depends on multiple factors. It could be if a patient has let's say a leaky valve, how well the blood pressure is controlled. If it's a stenotic valve, there's really nothing that is determining how fast the patient progresses. It's mostly the genetics of the patient. We don't quite understand why one group of patients go from mild to severe in a shorter period of time compared to another group of patients. And there's a lot of research happening in that space to understand that. But healthy lifestyles in general in the leaky valve space, that may delay the progression of disease from mild to severe. Again, a lot of this is unknown at this point, and we need more research to understand that.
But you're talking about possibly monitoring someone for years.
Correct. Sometimes we can monitor them. We have patients who have, for years, they have not progressed to the next level. Usually, once you get into moderate range, the progression gets faster. So that is when monitoring becomes more frequent. In a mild stage, you may need echocardiogram every 2 to 4 years. Whereas once you are moderate, the frequency of echocardiogram becomes smaller. If you are in the severe range or moderate to just getting to severe range, we may have higher frequency of doing echocardiograms just to make sure we don't miss that sweet spot of repairing or replacing before it gets too far.
Because it can get too far.
It can get too far, yes. Most common is that when patients say, I didn't think my symptoms were from my heart. Unfortunately, the valve load dysfunction and age go hand in hand. In the general population, 2% of patients have valve load disease. When you are above 65, especially above 70, 10% of patients have valve load heart disease. So 1 out of 10 people above the age of 70 have valve load heart disease. So it's very prevalent, it's very common. The problem is that some patients, depending on multiple factors, their access to healthcare, their personal beliefs, so multiple variables where a patient could not seek the care for the valve disease and then the valvular heart disease progresses to the degree that severely symptomatic patients, we have to really move fast to help them and repair them, and which we do all the time. The problem is now the heart has already enough damage that it wouldn't go back to all the normal. However, if we capture the valve disease in that severe range without too much heart dysfunction or damage to the heart, we are able to repair and almost get the patient back to the normal lifestyle and function, and they do very well for a very long time. The key is getting to them in a timely fashion.
So the worst meeting is when you have to say to somebody, it's too late, this isn't going to do any good at all.
Yes, so that's the hardest times in any physician's life when you have to go and tell a patient that at this point it's futile to try to repair or replace. However, I would say that this is again a discussion after a lot of investigations and people shouldn't assume anything. In general, even when the patients are pretty advanced, not that obviously we want to advocate that, because of this is a minimal invasive procedures, because of our expertise at our center, and we do one of the highest volume repair or replacements through a catheter in this region, we are able to offer something to those patients. However, we may not be able to reverse all the damage that has happened over the last months to years.
Exactly. There's too much damage to the heart muscle itself for maybe a valve replacement, but then, okay, we got to do something else to make you feel better living with this damage, or there's something else that may be able to be done. Because we're Debora, and yes, that's what we do.
Yes, absolutely.
So you talked about symptoms that could be felt, experienced, mm-hmm, visualized, the swelling in the legs, mm-hmm, but you can hear it too.
How do we diagnose valvular heart disease? Obviously, the number one thing is how a patient is feeling. If patient has symptoms, then we trigger the process of evaluating further. The evaluation starts with history taking and getting to know the symptoms of the patient. We mentioned shortness of breath, leg swelling, fatigue and tiredness. And then we do further investigation, which is auscultation, which means that you can hear a murmur, which you're referring to. And when you hear a murmur, that means the valve dysfunction has advanced.
Do different valves sound different when they're problematic?
Different valves have different sounds on auscultation. So with the stethoscope, when we listen to the patient, we know this is mitral valve leakiness or aortic valve stenosis. Mitral valve in general predominantly fails by leaking or with regurgitation, whereas aortic valve predominantly fails by stenosis, that it doesn't open well. So both sounds are different in nature, and we can identify by auscultation, but obviously with an echocardiogram, it is confirmatory. And it can exactly tell us which valve and how bad it is. Based on that, we can either, you know, monitor the patient if it's not bad enough, or go to the next level, which may include CT scan, cardiac MRI, or even heart catheterization.
The experience for a patient undergoing one of these procedures.
Valvular heart disease happens as we age, and we are not best candidates for open heart surgery either, because our bodies are also aging accordingly. So transcatheter minimally invasive procedures can help and offer a great value to those patients. Traditional open heart surgery is becoming higher risk, whereas the transcatheter procedures are minimally invasive and able to repair and replace the valves in that patient population without higher risk of complications. And fortunately, most of those patients, they can go home next day, which is extremely important, because if you are, let's say, 80 years old and you're stuck in the hospital for days, if not weeks, you're not going to do well just because you are bedridden, you are in a different environment instead of home. Whereas with the transcatheter therapies, you could be discharged home next morning, and then you're back with your family, back with your usual normal environment where you are comfortable, so you recover much faster. So that's another distinction between traditional open heart surgery and transcatheter therapies. So the traditional open heart surgery is the patient is intubated under general anesthesia. Patient chest is cracked open, and patient goes on a heart-lung machine, and then the heart tissue is cut to get to the valves, and then the valves are repaired or replaced by doing that. Once the surgery is complete, patient may have bleeding problems because very invasive procedure. Patient is usually in the intensive care unit for days at times, depending on which valve and how sick the patient was. There are risks of sternal wound infections. Obviously, a patient is not eating or drinking naturally during that time period. And it takes days to get out of the ICU or out of the hospital. And then when the patient goes home, it takes weeks, at least 3 months, to get back to their usual lifestyle. That is the traditional open heart surgery. Whereas a minimally invasive procedure from the groin is a tiny catheter, no stitching involved. We go all the way to the heart valves, and then through that catheter, we repair or replace the valve. This procedure, depending on which one, takes about 30 minutes to 1 hour, 1.5 hour at the most. And most patients can go home next morning, and they can resume their usual activities within a few days. Usually there is no significant limitations as they go back home. And within about 2 weeks, they're back to as usual activities with no limitations. That also translates into obviously safer, because if you are less invasive, generally speaking, you have less bleeding, you have less infections, you have no broken bones or cut bones or tissue. So in general, this is minimally invasive, and patients do much better with this.
That's Deborah interventional cardiologist Dr. Muhammad Raza. Join us for the next pod, the first Wednesday of next month, when Dr. Raza walks us through the minimally invasive ways he and his team at Deborah repair or replace faulty valves to get patients back to living their best lives. I'm Rasa Kay.
You can always listen to all of the informative doctor interviews at DeborahHealthReport.com. Schedule an appointment at DemandDeborah.org.